This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster. Hey, this is John Thornham over at Faster. I just finished recording a podcast with Scott Tindall, who's been on the podcast several times. And we get into an awesome conversation about protein. I've kind of been going down a rabbit hole recently on protein and the amount of protein that is required for the body, not only from an endurance perspective, but just from an overall health and longevity perspective. It's a really fascinating conversation that we have. We talk about the different types of protein, the amount of protein needed for athletes to stay fit and healthy, the differences on like protein timing and different types of meal plans, plant-based proteins versus whey and then beef isolate proteins, and a number of other things. We also touch on creatine, which if you listen to the last episode, this is a really fascinating conversation. And it's just a really, really interesting. So if you guys want to take a listen to this podcast, I think it's going to be great. Another thing I do want to say is Scott is a good friend of ours now. We've had him on the show several times. He's been a good buddy of ours. We met in Kona, and they're building an awesome company called Fuelin. I love what they're doing. Scott is one of the best out there. He worked with the Toronto Maple Leafs at one point. He's working with some amazing triathletes. You're going to learn more about that soon. And there's a number of other things that he's done. He worked on the Oracle boat. He's just a wealth of knowledge. Fuelin is an amazing program that is helping athletes fuel, and it's with great foods, and it's just it's an overall system that they have. They're offering a special promotion. It's going to be 30% off for your first month. It's a 3-month basic trial, and with code FLOW, FLO all caps and 30, you're going to get 30% off that first month. I think it's extremely beneficial. It just takes a lot of the thinking out of food and fueling. And they work with you. They have a number of different programs. So please check it out and go ahead and help these guys out. They're doing amazing things. Again, that code is FLOW30 if you want to get that 30% off. Anyway, on to the show. I hope you enjoy it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to Scott or ourselves, and we'll definitely get those answered for you. Talk to you soon and ride safe. When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show. Scott, welcome back to Faster. How you doing?
Good, John. How's things?
Things are good. Things are good. This is, I think, episode number 3 for you. So you're getting up there on our list of most frequent guests, but we love having you on. So we're happy to have you on and chat about some fun stuff today.
Thanks, man. It's always a pleasure having a good chat with you and talking shop in all things nutrition, triathlon, and wheels, I guess.
That's right. Today we're going to chat about protein. And to be honest with you, I have been going down the protein rabbit hole myself lately, so I'm pretty interested about this one. So we know protein is a macronutrient for sure. But let's talk about protein in general. There's so many things that are out there about protein. I think first thing let's talk about is sort of this conversation around how much protein is beneficial for a human to get in a day.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big one. we were talking about this as a team the other day, and you know, there's a lot of information out there, and there's, I think, sort of confusing information because it's being broken down into such minute science that is specific to, say, muscle protein synthesis versus whole body net protein balance. And it's like, yes, there are differences when we look at total amounts being given to a population, whether that be male, female, young or old. But I think when you look at the big picture, and I think this is what everyone's forgetting, it's like, look at the big picture here. Protein is not just for muscle. Like, it is involved in every cellular function and every cell in the human body. And so, like, we've got to get beyond this, like, oh, you hit your peak muscle protein synthesis with, you know, X amount of protein, and therefore you shouldn't be taking any more. It's like, well, what about the rest of the protein? Where does that go? yeah, you lose a little bit through oxidation, heat, you lose a bit out the toilet, but it's not like your body just says, oh, no more protein for me because I can't use it for muscle. And I think that's the really concerning bit, is when people are saying, well, you just don't need any more than that minimum amount.
Okay. So one thing that I've recently, I just read this book, actually, a book called Outlive by Peter Attia. I don't know if you've ever heard of that book.
We're going to talk about Peter today because he...
Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, because there was an article written, you know, there was this new study, and we can probably dive straight into it if you want, after you tell me what you're going to tell me. But there was a study which looked at a much higher dose of protein recently compared to a smaller dose and what the impact of what that was. And he wrote it's a really good article about it, but it's like diving too much into what he calls nutritional biochemistry without looking at the big picture. Like, he's focusing on, oh, it was a milk protein versus a whey protein, and therefore it doesn't necessarily tell us. And it's like, well, yeah, that's a slower digesting protein. Like, it's milk. It's cow's milk. People drink cow's milk. Nobody eats 5 meals of whey protein a day. And if you do, you're an idiot. Like, we've certainly got better things in our life to consume than whey protein every day, which maximizes muscle protein synthesis in a smaller dose because it's rapidly absorbed. Like, come on, like, look at the big picture here. It's food. They used a milk protein. Yes, it had casein in it, but it's milk. And that's cool. And you could probably then say, well, okay, how does that apply to then chicken and meat and things like that? But we'll get into that study. So anyway, tell me about Peter and Outlive. I've listened to the book on Spotify.
You've listened to the book?
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's a great book too. You know, it was something that I've been kind of going down this like longevity rabbit hole for the last while, like learning things about longevity and like really thinking through it. And one of the things that he talked about was obviously protein from a longevity perspective. And he said, I think it's under FDA, the recommendation is like 0.8 grams per kilogram, which when you break that down is like really low based on some of the other things I've heard, which is basically almost 2.2 grams per kilogram or 1 gram per pound. So I've been experimenting.
It's not the FDA. It's the World Health.
Was it World Health? So, okay.
Yeah.
So I've been experimenting with going up to 1 gram per pound of body weight per day. And like it, I've always eaten healthy, what I believe. And so I've just found like it is a lot of protein in one given day. But I'm interested to see what it does. And I wanted to get your opinion on that 1 pound per 1 gram per pound of body weight. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's probably, you know, around the lower end. Well, it's around that sort of, I wouldn't say lower end. So we will add fuel in based on the current research recommend for all athletes, male, old, female, or male, somewhere between 2 and 3 grams per kilo body weight of protein. And we can dive in the reasons why that and the research and whatnot. But what
say that number one more time? How much per pound?
Per kilogram.
How many? So
two to three grams per kilogram of weight.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Which is what you're talking about. So effectively, if you break that down, what you're doing is 2.2 grams per kilo body weight.
Yep.
When you're taking in your amount. Okay. When you're talking pounds to kilos. So a really easy way to think about it, and something we will often tell people, is whatever you weigh in pounds is roughly a good starting point for the amount of protein you should be taking in. So if you weigh, what do you weigh, 170?
No, about 160.
160? There you go. So you should be aiming for roughly 160 grams of protein per day.
And I've been doing that, which is, I mean, I think I eat a lot, but man, sometimes I feel like that's a good chunk of protein, but it's cool. I'm very interested to see what it looks like. How does it change based on somebody's activity level? If somebody is, I mean, obviously we have like Ironman athletes that are like a ton of endurance. We have people that aren't as involved. Maybe they're just out cycling for enjoyment. Does that really change the amount of protein that somebody is getting in the day? And if it does, why?
Activity and exercise is going to increase the requirement for protein.
Okay.
Now, whether you're doing endurance exercise or resistance-based exercise, there could be an argument that maybe there could be a difference in the protein requirement. I would tend to argue differently. I would say no. It's just if you're are getting older, which we all are. If you want to maintain lean muscle mass, yes, tick. If you're doing some exercise, you want to recover better. And if you're talking about, you know, cellular health and longevity and maintaining and improving body composition, yeah, you need a decent amount of protein in your life. Now, the average person will take in far too little protein if they want to maintain lean muscle mass in conjunction with exercise as they age. That's a given. And that's why you get, you know, the process of, say, sarcopenia and whatnot, sarcopenia being progressive loss of muscle as we age, which Peter talks about. And it's great that he's highlighting all these things.
So when you think about losing muscle as we age, I think it's after 40 for men that you start to lose a
28.
Is it 28? Wow, man, that's crazy.
And I say 28 with like some sort of authority. Like it's probably between 25 and 30. You start to lose.
So, but what they said in the book and one of the studies that they came up with was that they had, I think it was people over 60 that were doing strength training. And the only thing they could do with strength training was maintain muscle mass until they added protein, which then it allowed them even at an older age to build some muscle mass, not as much as a younger person. But I'm guessing based on what you're saying is if the protein amount per day is too low, there's no way that you could actually build any sort of muscle mass as you start to go through sarcopenia, like you're saying, when you're losing muscle mass due to age.
Correct. So there are some really cool studies with older people. There's one study in particular called Lift More. That's the acronym for it, LIFTMOR. Which looked at elderly women who were osteoporotic. And they did significant lifting, you know, with significant intensity, whole body sort of compound exercises. And what they took on protein, we saw changes in muscle mass, but we also saw significant changes in bone mineral density as well with that particular study. So what was previously thought to be very difficult or nearly impossible to change in terms of bone mineral density and muscle mass, it actually proved that if the stimulus was there and probably the nutritional input was there, that things can actually go in a positive direction, which I think is super that, you know, there can be these interventions that do result in positive change even when we get older. Now, you hinted at it there. You need to have both. So just taking in protein likely won't change things like muscle protein synthesis and the ability to either maintain lean mass or increase lean mass unless the stimulus is there to actually build that muscle. And again, this is the importance of resistance training as we get older, but certainly not just for older people. And I think, again, this is like the real bugbear that I have is like young, old, male, female, lift weights.
Yeah.
Okay. Whether you're doing endurance sports or not, just lift some weights at least twice a week, minimum. Young, old, male, female, consume protein. And that amount of protein, again, should probably be in that 2 to 3 grams. Like, yeah, there are some studies that, you know, again, talking about like premenopausal women with, you know, a menstrual cycle, and there are some changes in the way in which the human body, you know, the female body will oxidize protein and utilize protein in the luteal or the follicular phase. But it's like you're talking percentages here. It's like I was talking to Elizabeth Impen, one of our female nutrition coaches, and I was like, honestly, would you do that? Like, would you change your protein intake based on your cycle? I was like, isn't there like, don't you have enough on your mind already with your gut? She's like, oh my God, like the last thing I'm thinking about doing is changing my protein intake and reducing it during the follicular phase because, you know, I don't use it as well during that phase, or actually through the luteal phase. And it's like, just keep things simple.
Yeah.
Keep it constant. And this is the other thing, like, you know, people talk about like, oh, 40 grams of protein after is slightly better than a 30 gram hit of protein, which is better than a 20 gram hit of protein after a training session or in a particular feed. And what does that do to muscle protein synthesis and the way your body uses it? And it's like, think big picture here, people. That 20, 30, 40 grams of protein after one session doesn't do anything. It's what you eat across the entire day, as you're hinting at. Okay, how do I get in that 2 to 3 grams of protein per kilo body weight across the entire day, for the entire week, for the entire month and beyond, that's what makes the difference.
Yeah.
Like definitely. It's not 24 hours. And most of the studies, this is the cool thing about this new study, which was like investigating like the difference between 20 grams of protein versus 100 grams of protein in one hit. And it was looking at what happened with MPS, muscle protein synthesis over time, and the amino acids in the body and how it dealt with it. Now, the argument from Peter, as we said, is that, you know, it wasn't a fast-acting protein, therefore you didn't hit the threshold and stuff like that. But what it showed was that you could eat a large amount of protein in one hit, and that could provide benefit over a very long period of time, 12 hours, which was studied.
Yeah.
Now, most studies only have looked at 4 or 6 hours. Mm. So that's like also one of the nuances with this study is that like, were the other studies just too short in what they were investigating? And therefore, would you have seen, okay, maybe this peak, but then continued, maybe it went back up or continued at that peak level as they studied it further? We don't know. And probably the follow-up to this study that was done is probably going to investigate whey protein and look at it over that 12-hour period to see if taking a very large amount of whey protein could still have the same effect as, say, a milk protein or whole foods. And that's cool. So then suddenly you go, okay, maybe I can just eat a very large amount of protein either in the morning, at lunch or dinner, because that's when I feel like eating and that's how I feel like eating. And as long as that contributes to your total amount of protein in the day, job done.
One thing that he talked about, yeah, for sure. And one thing that he talked about in the book too, which I found was very interesting, he was talking about the concept of visceral fat. And he was saying that visceral fat, when they've been studying the beginning stages of it, is it actually starts in the muscles that have sort of not been activated, and it starts as a marbling in between the muscle fibers, and then it spreads out from there and goes into the body and creates visceral fat. When you increase your protein intake, and I understand if you're lifting weights, that's obviously sort of counteracting that visceral fat, but does the increase in protein actually help counteract the development and deposits of visceral fat?
I couldn't answer that truthfully. okay. I would doubt it. So it's not like, and again, my understanding of visceral fat isn't that it sort of starts in your muscle and then infiltrates into the other areas. The fat being created, you know, there is this process of lipogenesis where, you know, you create fat cells through excessive calories. You know, that's what's going to be happening, like excessive calories, whether it be, and the formation of fat from protein or carbohydrates is a difficult, you know, process. And I think it's overplayed. Like it's usually the overconsumption of calories in the form of fat that then results in, you know, fat cells being created. So does just taking in a heap of extra protein prevent visceral fat from forming? I wouldn't say so, especially if you're in a caloric surplus.
Right.
But if it's in conjunction with good training and that training is resistance-based and that allows you to develop muscle, then it would probably offset. I mean, visceral fat is very important. Like, don't get me wrong. Well, visceral fat is going to be a result of overconsumption of calories and probably underactivity or under the expenditure of energy just being lower than what you're consuming. And so you put on this fat, and that visceral fat or that fat around your organs is what develops over time.
Can an increase in caloric intake from protein be converted to fat stores?
It can, but it's very difficult. Like
I thought so, yeah.
So what some of the really cool studies on overfeeding on protein have shown that even if you take in, say, 3 to 3.5 grams per kilo body weight, and it's way in excess of what would be required, those individuals don't put on extra fat. Like
they normally just pee it out, right?
So you defecate it, so usually out the bum, and then out through your head in terms of heat. So you when you listen to the people who have done these protein overfeeding studies, they report feeling very hot all the time. So
that makes
it
sense.
It pushes up their metabolic rate.
Oh, fascinating. Another thing that he talked about, and I wanted to talk to you about, because this is kind of fascinating to me, and we touched on a little bit in the beginning, was this concept of like the biochemistry. And one of the things he makes a point about is this concept of while he does believe that shopping the perimeter of the grocery store is better for you than shopping in the middle, he talked about when you get down to the molecular level of the food, ultimately it's all made of like atoms. So he was kind of making an argument that it maybe doesn't necessarily matter as much what you eat. However, I would in some capacity disagree, because I do believe that, you know, especially if you're looking at foods that have a bunch of stuff sprayed on them, those are not good things to ingest. But he talked about even the differences of the proteins. And I know there's like whey protein. One that I take a lot from a supplemental perspective is a grass-fed beef isolate. There's plant proteins. He was arguing that those don't perform as well as meat-based proteins. Can you break down maybe the bucket of proteins and your opinion on each one of them? Because it's there's a lot of them.
Yeah. And this is, yeah, we were talking about this the other day. So I think first and foremost, like there is a big difference in the quality and types of foods you consume.
Agreed.
So, and I think this is where a lot of people go wrong. At the moment, there's this massive focus on macros. And I've seen this with athletes. They're like, I hit my macros, but God, I'm like, I'm not like losing weight, or I'm always hungry and that. And you look through their food diary and they've eaten like a protein bar that, yeah, gives you 20 grams of protein, gives you 10 grams of fat, and it gives you 20 grams of carbs. It's this big and I'm holding my fingers up. It's like, you know, 3 centimeters long. You can eat it in 2 bites. And next minute you're like, what else can I eat? And so, yes, you're hitting your macros, but the quality of those macros is extremely poor in the sense of the ability to keep you satiated, to provide you with good quality fiber, provide you with quality micronutrient intake. And that's where the argument, and again, like, I mean, it's very American focused, that book and the podcast, like about like the periphery versus the central. But yes, the first area you should go to is the fruit and vegetable section. Now, fiber, he does talk about fiber and it is good, but that's a prime reason to be eating fruits and vegetables and whole grains. You know, fiber, we know that fiber, based on meta-analysis, systematic reviews, is important for the health, despite what carnivore advocates will tell you, that plants are killing you. Yeah, fiber is certainly very important. You talk about glucose control. Fiber has a significant impact on that. If people are wearing CGMs, bump up your fiber intake and you'll see changes in that CGM data. Yeah. And people, like, what is it? The average, I think the average American consumes less than 10 grams of fiber a day. The recommended amount by the World Health Organization is 35 to 40 grams of fiber per day.
And one thing I've learned over the last several years is the idea that if you are eating fruit and you're consuming it as the whole fruit as opposed to the juice, it's paired in a lot of ways with that fiber. So they kind of neutralize each other. They balance each other out. So that's why you're saying when you increase your fiber, if you're wearing a continuous glucose monitor, that drops that spike in insulin because it's paired with the fiber, right?
Well, the fiber will help blunt it. Like, you know, if you're doing a juice, yeah, you're just getting probably a straight hit of glucose and fructose without the fiber in there. So, you know, that's, and again, Tio talks about that. Like, he's seen people become sort of, you know, pre-diabetic through juicing.
Yeah.
You drink, it's like taking on a heap of Morton or Precision or something like that, but on a daily basis when you're not actually going out and doing a 2-hour, you know, ride.
Yeah.
Again, context is important. So your point about the animal and plant, because we'll keep focused on protein. Look, the old thinking was that plant protein was not, and this is always the issue with a book. You know, a book becomes out of date pretty quickly as soon as studies come out. Although I would say that there were plenty of studies already available to show that plant protein versus animal protein, there are a lot of similarities. And so the old thinking was that plant protein wasn't as effective as whey protein in terms of stimulating muscle protein synthesis. And that's because there is this lower postprandial after eating. This seems to be slightly lower in terms of muscle protein synthesis. But again, that might be related to the duration of the studies. At that time, weren't looking at it for long enough. So they were looking at it for a very short window and not necessarily researching what happened after that. There is a different amino acid composition comparing animal proteins to plant proteins. So they will have lower amounts of, say, leucine, methionine, isoleucine and whatnot, especially when you talk about those essential amino acids or the branched chain amino acids, in particular leucine, there are some lower amounts in plant proteins compared to animal proteins, leucine being one of those key triggers for muscle protein synthesis that everyone will talk about. The absorption kinetics and the digestion of plant protein is slower than, say, a whey protein. Again, that was what was talked about, the difference between a milk protein versus a whey protein is that there is different absorption rates there. And yes, you could argue for a study, that's really important, but in real life, does it really matter? Like, slower might be considered better over the course of like your lifetime because it keeps it there. So they're probably the things. So then you start going, okay, well, if there's different amino acid compositions, there's different rates of absorption or the use of those by the human bodies, and the total amount of protein in plant sources is lower, what do you do? Okay, well, you just got to eat more of the plant protein to get the equivalent amount of protein and the equivalent amount of amino acids. Now, that's obviously a consideration because suddenly caloric intake might have to go up and thinking about that. So that's one consideration. What we've now looked at in multiple studies is when they're comparing a whey protein to, in particular, a mixed plant protein source. So think pea, pumpkin, soy, brown rice. When any of these combinations of plant proteins are mixed and compared with similar dosages, so i.e. whey protein, 30 grams of protein, and the plant protein actually delivering 30 grams of protein, very similar rates of muscle protein synthesis, improvements in strength, improvements in power, improvements in rate of and rate of force production.
One of the best things
really
I ever
difference. Not really any difference.
And one of the best things I ever heard described to me, it was actually on a documentary. It was talking about the concept of veganism, and it was talking about protein synthesis and talking about the amino acids and basically how a lot of people were making arguments that you just can't get the same amount of protein intake. But what it explained was that basically animals are the middleman to producing.
That stuff's terrible. Was that in the documentary? Like that.
It was basically saying they were the middleman. So that basically the amino acid chain is combined, but they say if you eat the right mixture, like you just said, that it does produce an efficient protein from a plant source. Is there anything with that, or is that like a little goofy?
That whole thing. I was talking to my dad, who's a vet, and he was like, "What a load of shit!" literally, like, he's like, "A cow is a fermentation like factory, like on four legs." He's like, "What they're talking about is absolute BS." So, look, the take home is when you look at these plants, okay,
yeah,
these plants have different amino acid compositions and differing amounts of them. Combine them together to get the correct amounts. And you don't have to do any like fine tuning here. Just find a product that has probably two or three plant blends in it.
Yeah.
And look at the label per scoop. Does it provide you with 25 or 30 grams of protein? Look at, maybe look at the amino acid breakdown if it's there. Look at leucine. Does it provide you with somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5 grams of leucine? Good.
You're fine.
Now, if it's a lower amount, let's say it only provides you, and this is what you often see, so a scoop of whey protein will give you, a good quality whey protein isolate will give you around 25 grams of protein.
Okay.
And it might give you 3.2 grams of leucine. Great. You're like, that's awesome. Okay. That's still only 25 grams. I'd still be recommending to someone probably have 1.5 scoops of that.
Yeah.
To give you up to 40 grams of protein. Now, for the plant-based athlete taking the plant-based source, I'd probably say to them, okay, it's only giving you 20 grams of protein in that scoop with, say, 2 grams of leucine. Well, to get the equivalent amount of what I'm recommending to an animal-based athlete who is happy to consume whey, have 2 scoops. Now you got 40 grams of plant protein with 4.5 grams of leucine. Whoopity-doo.
There you go.
Like, yeah, God, like,
doesn't matter.
You don't have to complicate this. Like, if your preference, and to be fair, like, so I use a company called True Protein. It's an Australian company. It's great. It's got minimal, like, intervention, I think is probably the best word. Like, I look at a lot of the American companies and there's a lot of added ingredients in there where I'm like, why would I be taking that? Whereas True is very true to their word. They minimally sort of manufactured stuff. Now, I'm not a massive fan of plant protein, and their original ones were, you know, they're very chalky. I don't know if you've had many, like, eating chalk, literally, like some of them. And you're like, oh God, this is awful. Their latest batch is fantastic. Like, it's super smooth. They use a faba bean in there. I think it's brown rice and a soy protein. Hits all the marks. I'm like, it's pretty good. Like, I don't have it all the time because it's not my favorite, but sometimes I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to have plant protein today. I'm fine with that.
Like, have you ever had a grass-fed beef isolate? Have you ever had anything in that form?
Yeah. So a lot of that, I think, is marketing garble.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Like, so what, I mean, what do you think?
I haven't seen enough studies on it to say that for sure, but look, yeah, we know the studies work. We look at multiple forms of plant protein. We look at whey protein. We look at whey protein concentrates, and we look at milk protein concentrates. It's like, you know, I'd need to look at the specific amino acid breakdown in that, but it's like people using collagen as a form of protein. Do not use collagen as your primary source of protein.
No,
you're looking to increase muscle protein synthesis, because the amino acid breakdown in that is completely different. You're literally lacking leucine in there. I mean, yes, it's going to be higher in lysine and tyrosine and whatnot, but and proline in particular, which is why it's good for the skin, but it's not going to help you stimulate muscle. And so I think that's really, and look, honestly, when people are taking collagen, they're like, do I include this as my protein amount? I'm like, view it as bonus. Have your 10 to 15 grams of collagen for your beautiful skin. You clearly take a bit of collagen in. You got no wrinkles. And so, you know, like, just take it in, have it as a bonus, and just get on with it. If that's your nighttime shot of collagen, great.
Yeah. Is there any, so if you have somebody that is like allergic to dairy, is there anything wrong with a like beef isolate protein? Let's assume the amino acids are correct. Like, you get the right amount of leucine, you get the right amount of stuff going on. There's nothing negative about it, is there?
Well, again, is it just a collagen? I'd need to have a look at the, I don't know the exact breakdown, but is
it's definitely not just a collagen, because I do know about the collagen comp. Like, I don't consider collagen protein based on the amino acid chain for sure. Yeah. So I'm definitely,
it is a protein. It's definitely a protein.
It is, but not like
it's not a protein. It's not a protein that would be recommended to enhance lean muscle mass, put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. What are your thoughts on the amount of, I had a guy on the podcast a while ago. He wrote a book about the Banting diet, which talked a lot about basically matching 1 gram of protein for 1 gram of carbs on your plate. What do you think about that?
I think if you're looking at studies which look at body composition, improvements in body composition and weight loss, then it's a fair sort of ratio. We do know when you look at some of those studies that if you balance that out, and that's a really easy trick you can use, the amount of protein to the amount of carbs, it tends to work pretty well for body composition. Is it what I would advise for an endurance athlete without knowing their training volume or their, you know, their hours and their intensity? No.
You say so, higher carbs.
Yeah, it's a pretty rudimentary, it's not very much, sort of science to that diet, is there? Like, and it's not very hard to sort of push out on. I don't know. Like, I'm like, yeah, that's, is there a lot of thought behind that? I don't know. Just matching protein to carbs. Like, it comes down to calorie balance. And if you're in a caloric deficit, you're going to lose weight. Like, you're going to lose body fat. You're going to lose body mass. How big that deficit is going to probably be the determining factor on whether you lose lean muscle mass as well as fat mass when you do that. And that's always the trick.
So talk to me a bit about more like what you guys are doing at Fueling, because I know we've talked about it on the show before. It's super cool. When you are incorporating protein into somebody's diet, and like you're saying, it's key not just to say I hit my macros with eating basically junk to get there. How do you look at the three macros as when you use Fuel In, and like, how are you trying to pick the right amount of macros for each person as they're using Fuel In?
Yeah. I mean, as we said, I think we have a fairly, the rule you could say is a general rule, but I think it's based, you know, on the science, especially if we're talking about protein in particular, like we are giving and we'll start athletes on around that 2.2 grams.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't go below. They certainly, I mean, there are some use cases where we might use a slightly lower, around 1.8 grams per kilo body weight, but generally speaking, it will be in that 2 to 3 grams. So that's a good starting point, I think, for any athlete listening or wanting to try and improve their protein intake relative to what they're trying to achieve. So if you are trying to be an athlete, and an athlete is anyone doing any exercise, I would certainly urge you to consider taking in more protein in around those ranges. Now, there are some caveats to that. If you've got renal disease, kidney disease, whatnot, then certainly check with your
doctor,
primary healthcare practitioner or your nutrition expert, whoever that is, hopefully someone with a degree, not just fantastic abs. But, you know, like, you want to check that out. But look, even with higher protein intakes, even up around 3, 3.5, I think even up to 4 grams per kilo body weight, it's been found that that's safe from a kidney function perspective. So, you know, that you always hear these, like, probably ill-informed or, probably ill-informed practitioners, sometimes medical practitioners who don't really know much about nutrition, not because, probably more because they haven't learnt about it. And it's just more the schooling is, and I talk to my doctor friends, they're like, oh yeah, we had an hour on nutrition in the whole 8 years or 5 years of university. And it's like, well, you can't expect a doctor to know that, much like you couldn't expect me to know everything about, you know, medications, because that's where their primary sort of knowledge is, I guess. So, that notion of a higher protein intake is going to be dangerous for your kidneys and for your body has sort of been, you know, pushed out due to research. And it is something we constantly have to go back to and look at the systematic reviews and the meta-analysis and push those to those people who are saying high protein intake is dangerous for you, because it's just clearly not there.
Not there. And so there is no difference between men and women. You're saying it's pretty even, like,
I'm not saying there isn't a difference. I'm saying that when you look at the differences, so physiologically, yes, women are very different to men.
Of course. Okay.
And as we age, men and women, there is this sense of anabolic resistance. And so the need for higher amounts of protein probably becomes more prevalent as we age. Now, the difference here is that, and this is what I've tried to explain before with people, is it's not that suddenly women and men who are getting older, suddenly we found, oh, you need more protein. It's like we just didn't know that you needed the same amount of protein as what a younger person needs, because we didn't have the studies. So I think the general thought was, oh, you're getting older, you're doing less, you don't need as much protein, eat less. The reality is actually, no, you definitely need as much as that young person exercising. Wow. And so it's not necessarily that they're a special group. It's just now we know what they need. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, I've done a lot of volunteer work in a nursing home. I have a dog that's a therapy dog, and I take him in there. And a lot of times I'm there during like mealtime. And I mean,
terrible.
Oh man, no wonder they're wasting away to nothing. I mean, that's just, there's like almost zero protein on those plates. It's pretty sad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, my grandma, she passed away a few years ago now, but like I can ongoing arguments with the head of the nursing home and the dietitian about her taking on a whey protein supplement, like just to give her more protein and to allow her then get her up exercise. And it was like, no, she doesn't need that. And I'm like, on what planet? Like, and I remember sending, I mean, they hated me because I sent like so many studies across, like looking at the impact of higher protein intake on elderly people and what can happen in conjunction with exercise and improvements in quality of life. But it just, there was a lot that could be done for elderly people in terms of nutritional intervention and exercise intervention in nursing homes. And it's just not done. And that's just a sad fact, unfortunately.
It is. What about, I want to talk about this. You and I are both pretty relatively new parents. I definitely have a young guy that models a lot of what we eat. How early in life does this protein you know, when you think about the number of grams of protein that a toddler would get, are we still matching that, or does that happen later in life?
Well, I don't think you need to be too specific. And I heard, it's funny, we're talking about Atiyah again, because he was on a podcast with, what's the professor's name? It'll come to me. Anyway, Atiyah said something about like kids and his son, and it's protein, protein, protein. And the guy, the PhD, the researcher, he was like, yeah, but think about it. Like, even if you're giving 2 grams per kilo body weight, like think about how much protein that is. You don't need to supplement a kid who's eating normally, because 2 grams when they weigh 10 kilos, that's 20 grams.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in a slice of toast or bread, you get 7 or 8 grams of protein.
Yeah.
Like a cup of yogurt, you're going to get 5 or 6 grams of, you know, protein. In a cup of milk, you get another 3 or 4. Like, it adds up pretty quickly from non-protein sources. And then you're also trying to get your kid to have a little bit of red meat, you know, maybe some pate for iron. You know, you're getting them to eat fish for the omegas, but also some protein. Like, you're probably, I mean, kids are probably taking in way more than 2 or 3 grams per kilo of body weight when you think about it. So you certainly don't need to be thinking about supplementing them in that sense if they've got a normal eating behavior.
Okay, so there's no real age. It's not like once they hit 14.
Oh, no, there would be. There would be. Look, I don't deal with children in that sense. And adolescents, we get asked a lot about adolescents and coming on to fuel in. I usually deflect it to Dr. Alan McCubbin, who's and Megan Foley. They're both registered dietitians on the fuel in program. And I usually deflect to them because they've got more experience from that clinical side. You know, we get asked a lot about like, you know, and it's just the way of the world now, isn't it? Kids are in the gym, 16, smashing weights. Like, I mean, you go down to the beach here in Sydney and there's kids there and you're like, Jesus, like they are stacked these days. And they're at obviously 16, got right? Their nutrition. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Like they're obviously eating a lot of protein. They're eating a lot of calories to get that muscle bulk. And they're obviously doing some fairly significant resistance training to get those physiques. But, you know, and a lot of them will be taking things like creatine, monohydrate, and stuff like that. And again, the safety of creatine is very well established. I would argue you certainly don't want a child, you know, less than 16 taking on something like creatine or excessive amounts of protein. But I guess from 16 onwards, you know, case by case, and if it's followed, certainly, if they are doing, you know, high volumes of training with high intensity, they're certainly going to need some nutritional support to allow them to be optimized.
Our last episode actually was on creatine. I don't know if you heard it or not, but I just want to get your 2 cents on creatine as a nutritionist. What do you think about it?
Do you take it?
I don't. Never have.
Why not?
I don't know. I think honestly, if I'm thinking about when I first heard about creatine, was probably when I was in high school, which would have been late 90s. And I was going to the gym and creatine was like, there was such a bad name about it. It was almost like you were taking a steroid if you were taking creatine. Right. And I think that that's sort of how I was raised learning about creatine. And I actually had a guy on a couple weeks ago and I was talking to him and I was thinking, man, I just have a huge miseducation about creatine. So we had a interesting talk about it. I've been thinking about it since. I haven't done it yet, but I'm just wondering what your stance is.
Well, I'd ask again, why wouldn't you take it? Like there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't. If you're on a longevity quest, like, geez, take creatine. So it is pretty much, I mean, if you take out carbohydrates or water as a supplement being studied, I think it is the most studied sports ergogenic aid that has been studied. And with, again, you'll hear people say, oh, creatine is bad for the kidneys. Absolute BS. Like, there is so many systematic reviews and meta-analyses on the safety and the efficacy of creatine. The IOC, the Olympic committee, they put it as one of the very few. I think there's 4 or 5 supplements that they say actually has a positive effect. Creatine is one of them. Yeah, so from increasing in lean mass, improvements in strength, improvements in power, improvements in body composition, improvements in hydration status, improvements in endurance performance, like creatine is like studied and has this positive effect. So
how do you dose it?
The only negative outcome can be an increase in body weight, which again is probably offset if you don't do a lot of the loading phase, which is pretty much not required. So the old thinking used to be, I remember when we were playing rugby and creatine was all coming out, and firstly, it's not a steroid. Okay, so that's really important for people to know.
Yeah.
But creatine is found generally in meat products. So if you're a vegan or a vegetarian-based athlete, you are probably going to see a very good effect from taking in creatine, because it will increase creatine stores within your muscles, probably, which have probably been quite depleted. So you probably will feel pretty good when you start taking creatine, versus, say, maybe someone who's an omnivore. And there are non-responders to creatine as well. That is important to note. Some people just don't get any impact. We don't really understand why. Probably some genetic thing. The old thinking was you took 20 grams a day for 5 days, and then after that you took a maintenance dose of, say, 5 grams a day. That would get you fully loaded up, I think, in It was like less than 2 weeks. It would get your stores fully loaded. Nowadays, the thinking is just take 5 grams a day. That will get you fully loaded up within 30 days, 28 to 30 days.
Yeah. In terms of your muscle stores. So you do 5 grams a day.
Well, actually, so then there's more research coming out, which is unrelated to, say, muscle. And I think this comes back to what we said right at the start, is like, let's get beyond just focusing on muscle. Like, so creatine, I'm sure your guy that came on would have talked about the latest research in relation to the brain and what it's doing from cognition standpoint. And potentially offsetting things like neurodegenerative diseases, the use of creatine in concussion. So high doses of creatine in concussion, and treatment of concussion is now being investigated. So again, this is a little bit like the protein conversation. The old days used to be everyone just take 20 grams of protein after a meal because that's what you need to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. What they forgot was that there are people of different sizes. And so, like, you only had to look at Arnold Schwarzenegger and go, I'm pretty sure he's not consuming 20 grams of protein after a big weight session. He was probably consuming a lot of other stuff. But if you looked at bodybuilders and what was happening in practice, they were consuming huge amounts of protein and huge amounts of calories to get those physiques, along with a lot of anabolic steroids, obviously. But the point being is, now we then realize is, well, maybe protein is related to the amount of body mass that an individual has. And there seems to be some sort of shift with that with creatine as well. So maybe lighter people, maybe around 75, 80 kilos, only needs 5 grams a day. Maybe as you get above 80 kilos, and again, I'm only picking out a number here, maybe you need a little bit more to help cross over the blood-brain barrier. So 10 grams might actually make you feel a little bit better and be completely safe from a renal perspective, but have the added benefits of maybe helping with the brain as well as with the muscle. So, yeah, I take 10 grams a day. And look, creatine is creatine monohydrate. Take it in that form. You don't need to take the creatine HCL or liposomal creatine and all these other things that are being done. Like, creatine monohydrate, what used to be very cheap until Andrew Huberman started talking about it, and then everyone realized that creatine was pretty cool, and so the prices of creatine have jacked up, which is unfortunate, but... You know, whether you're an endurance athlete, a strength-based athlete, or like intermittent type sports athlete, I would certainly recommend taking creatine monohydrate.
Do you take a certain brand supplements that you really like?
So Crea Pure is
Crea Pure.
Crea Pure is the manufacturer of a very good quality creatine monohydrate. There are brands that then use Crea Pure. So True Protein uses Crea Pure. I believe Momentus used to use it and then actually stopped using it. And I'm not really sure why. But I would look for that Crea Pure logo if you are buying creatine monohydrate.
Cool.
It's great, man. Like, it's just one of, like, there's two supplements I consider like non-negotiables and you just take on a daily basis and you're just thinking, I just take this every day. Like, it's not going to make you feel like caffeine or anything like that or beta-alanine, but you take creatine every day and you take fish oils every day.
Yeah, definitely do that. And I also take vitamin D because this Canadian blood, man, that doesn't... I am deficient.
Vitamin D would be one of those ones where I'd probably take based on testing. So I'd probably manipulate the amount of vitamin D based on your blood test, whereas with creatine, You can do an Omega 3 index test, which is very cool if you haven't done it. Omega Quant is a company that does the Omega 3 index. It's such a great test, and it just gives you a very clear line in the sand of where you sit. You hopefully are in that 8 to 12% range. And if you're not, you either take more fish oil supplement or you start eating small oily fish on a daily basis. And the cool thing is, like, we did a small scale study with some of the FuelAn athletes, and we got all their baselines and that. Then they started supplementing with between 3,000 and 4,000 milligrams of EPA, DHA, and, you know, tested them two months later, and, you know, they all went up. It's like, it's not hard. Like, interventions that are directed, and you have a baseline and you retest, it's like, you know, test, don't guess, sort of thing. So that's pretty cool.
That's cool.
I know what we were talking about before as well. You were talking about the difference between old and young. So if we look at menopausal women, so what we know is they get told to take like a Mediterranean type base diet, which is a lot of plants. Okay, that's great. Fish, olive oil, all that. But when we look at what happens with menopausal women, it does seem that they definitely need to take on high amounts of protein. Now, again, that high amount of protein isn't necessarily less than what a younger person takes on, but they certainly need to take it on. And historically, menopausal women will probably be consuming less. Okay, so it is really important that they do take on. If you look at what they do, they will drop lean body mass. Again, differing studies, somewhere between, you know, 0.2 and 0.5 gram, 0.5 kilos in a year. Fat mass will go up somewhere between half a kilo and a kilo per year once they hit full menopause. Now, can that be offset? Potentially. Maybe through protein intake, because maybe that has an impact on the other macronutrients that they're taking. And that's another really important point. So there was a really cool study that came out from an Australian university where they talked about this thing called protein leverage effect. And so what menopause does, menopause increases protein breakdown in women. We know that. Okay. What it also drives is a protein-specific appetite. And so what they call this is the protein leverage effect. So when you take in more protein as a menopausal woman, it actually reduces the intake of non-protein energy. I.e. carbohydrates and fats. So it's like, if you're taking more protein, you're probably more likely to reduce your intake of carbohydrates and fats. Now, the reverse can be seen on that as well when they've done these studies. Take in lower amounts of protein, that appetite and that drive then gets pushed towards carbohydrates and fats. So you start taking in more carbohydrates and fats.
Oh, wow.
Now, when you start doing that, if you think about fat has 9 calories per gram. Carbohydrates have the same as protein, but it's very easy to eat 4 or 5 slices of toast or bread or a cake or whatnot than it is to, say, eat a 200 gram chicken breast.
Yeah.
And so it's my view on this is that, yes, the protein can have a significant impact on what you tend to choose. And if you eat lower amounts of protein, you're then going to choose the other products, the other macronutrients. And it's not the other macronutrients that are necessarily making you gain fat mass or lose lean mass. It's the total calories associated with those, because it's much easier to overconsume calories through carbohydrates and fats.
Yeah.
And that's where I think a lot of women get it wrong.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
In relation to menopause. So that's really cool. And like that's some new research that's come out, and I think that's super exciting. What we also know with menopausal women is that an amount of protein, even up to 1.6 grams per kilo body weight, doesn't seem to have any effect on them. So double the World Health Organization's recommendation doesn't seem to have any impact on retention of lean body mass or reductions in fat mass.
What about a pregnant woman?
That's pretty cool.
What about pregnancy?
I don't get into pregnancy.
Okay. That's fair. We've been around pregnant wives, but that's about it.
You certainly, you would keep it in a healthy range. And the healthy range, again, if they're still, look, a pregnant woman should continue exercising up until the point in which they're told not to. When you're exercising, you've still got needs. You're still going to need protein to maintain net protein balance, maintain muscle mass. I mean, unfortunately, you do see this. You see pregnant women stop exercising, become very deconditioned, gain a lot of weight. It's not necessary. And I think it's getting much better, that message of like continue exercising whilst pregnant and continue eating, and you don't need to eat for two. That's
a big myth.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the actual numbers of increased caloric requirement, it's actually pretty small.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. So, you know, things like that are cool. So look, again, with menopausal women, where would I say? We know that higher amount of protein, double the amount of World Health Organization amount, isn't enough to get you there. We can look at then, okay, well, what's the amount that we know works for premenopausal women, older men, and younger women? Well, okay, we come into that amount of around 2 grams per kilo body weight as a minimum amount. And so I'd say, well, let's apply that to menopausal women as well.
Okay.
And there's no harm in doing that. I think it's just like, let's keep it simple. It's the same amount.
I love it.
So that's where we sit. And, you know, if I just really reiterate, us at Fuel In, look, we say total protein intake is first priority that someone should be focusing on. That's 2 to 3 grams per kilo body weight. The second is quality. So plant, animal, as long as you're getting enough of it, doesn't probably make too much difference. The third is timing. So much like this study, you could eat all your protein in one meal if you really wanted to. If you wanted to eat 170 grams of protein in one meal, go for it. But good luck getting off the couch for the rest of the day. So now it comes down to practicality. Practical application is king, and that's what we try and do with Fuel In. So that idea of meal spacing, which used to be, oh, you're keeping amino acids in your blood and that's helping with muscle development. Like, that's probably old science, okay, based on this new stuff. And it's like, that's not the reason why you might have meal timing. The meal timing is A, to allow you to eat the total amount of protein, and B, to allow you to function in whatever you're doing during the day. If you've got a run coming up in the afternoon, you probably don't want to eat, you know, half a kilo of cow for lunch to get your protein in, because your run's going to suck. So protein timing, much like carbohydrate timing, is about practical application. And that's what we try and do with spacing the protein out throughout the day. Same with carbohydrates, giving you carbohydrates before key sessions, certainly taking carbohydrates and protein after key sessions, thinking about the day forward, 24 hours, what are you doing the night before and the day before to allow you to do, you know, whatever it is you're doing in 24 hours time.
And so I like that. Definitely, because I think, you know, I do have a restricted window. Like, I do some intermittent fasting. I don't eat like through certain times, but I've had some people who have recently talked to me about this one meal a day diet, and they've said, oh, it's the best thing in the world. And I'm like, I don't know how I could possibly consume in one meal what I feel like my body needs in one feeding window. Like, I mean, I do eat a lot. I've always been somebody who's like a big eater, but if you told me I had to sit down and eat 170 grams of protein in one meal, oh my gosh, I would, like, you'd have to roll me out of the kitchen.
But the reality, John, is so those diets work. You know the reason the diets work? And their primary focus, well, the primary focus of that diet is to lose weight.
Yeah.
So the reason it works is because you can't eat all your calories in one session. Whoa. Suddenly you're in a caloric deficit. Jesus. Like, I mean, it is so stupid. It is so stupid. So you're not getting your total calories in, but you're also doing a massive disservice because you're probably not getting your protein in. Like, okay, if you're going to eat one meal a day, fine. Get all your protein in. Get all your carbs in as best you can, and make sure there's at least some fat in there to help with, like, you know, endocrine function, hormone function and whatnot. But it is certainly – and then good luck if you're exercising in the morning or afternoon, because you're going to be just – you're just going to be all over the place. So if there's any endurance athletes out there who are thinking of this one meal a day, like – and we joked about this because, like, obviously this new study where it shows, like, you could eat, like, a huge amount of protein. I can just say it now. Like, there'll be a, you know, the one protein hit diet coming out, and it, there'll be a book written about it. And it's like, well, I don't know what's going to be in the book. There'll be a lot of filler, but the, like the one page, like cheat will be one meal a day with all your protein. And that's it. Like, it's like, wow.
My grandmother, so, when I was young, she used to joke all the time. She would say, one day you're going to be able to take a pill. You're going to be able to take a pill, and that's going to be your whole, all everything you need. And I'm like, I don't want that day to come. There's no the way Jetsons. I want that day to come. I know.
Do,
right?
you, remember, do you remember the Jetsons?
They used to I have do.
Their roast meal and a pill. So
it roast meal.
Yeah, I think. And sorry, the last thing is then after timing, I would say sex and age is the last thing you need to probably be concerned with if your total amount of protein is on point, the quality of the protein on point, and the timing is on point. Like, let's just stop confusing this. And I know, like, I know there are practitioners out there who talk, you know, are really emphasizing the difference between male and female. And that's great. Like, it has definitely increased the awareness of the physiological differences between men and women. However, the practical application doesn't make any difference.
I love it.
And that's, and that's probably what I'd leave with.
Well, let's do this then. Let's ask the what point question. So let's say you have somebody come in who follows the World Health Organization standard of what, 0.8 grams per kilogram or whatever, or per kilogram.
Yeah.
And they're an endurance athlete. They got a 300 watt FTP. You bump them up to the 2 to 3 watts or grams per kilogram. What are you going to see in performance for those guys?
I think I had this same response last time. Someone on 0.8 grams per kilo body weight ain't going to have a 300 watt FTP for starters. I think last time you said to me, and I was like, how many people have a 300 FTP?
Going anyway, back, I wish I would have not used that number, but we did.
Yeah. What would they, I don't, look, honestly, taking in protein. So the protein's not going to suddenly make you a superhuman endurance athlete.
Okay.
I think that's really important. But what it will allow you to do is recover. And if we're talking about endurance athletes in particular, this is the difference. It's the recovery. And this is what we hear time and time again from fueling athletes. They're like, holy shit. Like, I feel like I can do a second session. I can recover the next day. I'm not as sore. I can do this. Like, recovery is improving. And that's from a muscle perspective. That's probably from a bone perspective. That's from a cardiovascular perspective, because protein is involved in every cellular process. And so I can't tell you, like, it's not like carbs. If someone's on a low carb versus a high carb, and it's pretty clear what's going to happen to FTP. I think the ability to probably reproduce the training over time that allows them to adapt and allows them to do those sessions that eventually pushes that FTP up, then I would say they have a significant improvement there.
Perfect. I love it. Listen, man, you're always a legend on this show. Love having you here. Wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much for jumping on with us. And I'm sure we'll have you back on again to talk about something fun.
Awesome, man. That was very, very, very enjoyable. I know we went all over the place.
It's part of the fun.
People might have a few questions from it, but happy to answer them. And look forward to the next one.
Cool. And if they want to get you, fuelin.com, right?
Fuelin.com. Instagram is at getfuelin. We need to chuck you some sort of code or something and give all your listeners a decent percentage off for the first month and see if they enjoy it. It's always good.
Perfect. All right, man. Thanks.
Cool. Cheers, bud. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.